I move to approve the agenda.
Second.
The agenda's been moved and seconded. Is there any objection to moving the agenda along as written? Seeing no objection, we will go right on with the agenda. That takes us to persons to be heard on non-agenda items. Madam Clerk.
Public comment pertaining to education on non-agenda items is limited to 3 minutes per person per meeting. There will be up to 1 hour for persons to be heard. Public comment on agenda items will be taken at the time the agenda is considered. This is your opportunity to be heard, and the board will not respond to your comments. As per board policy 1312, individuals testifying may not discuss complaints against individual employees. Specifically, under these guidelines, the speaker states his or her name for the record. The speaker is limited to 3 minutes per meeting. The speaker is limited to non-agenda items. Agenda items will be open for the public comment as they appear on the agenda. The speaker's comment should be appropriate for all audiences, including school-age children. The speaker is limited to comments of a general nature, positive or negative, which may not be attributable to any specific individual. Issues involving concerns specific to any individual should be submitted in writing and given to the board clerk to be resolved. The issue may be determined to be appropriate for persons to be heard, or may be handled in executive session, or may be routed through a more appropriate complaint process. No disturbance or willful interruption of any board meeting shall be permitted. Persistence by an individual or group shall be grounds for the chair to terminate the privilege of addressing the meeting. The board may remove disruptive individuals and order the room cleared if necessary. This is not a question and answer time. Speakers may be referred to the superintendent or designee, or take the issue under advisement. And this is the first half hour. And we have two people signed up. We have Sarah Mayfield.
Is it red one? Yes, okay. Good evening, my name is Sarah Mayfield. I reside in Palmer. I'm here today because I wanted to ensure that the school board is aware that the school district currently has no formal policy requiring parents be pre-notified to significant changes to children's schedules. My child is in middle school. Recently, my middle school decided to change her schedule with no discussion, no advance notification, and no communication with me whatsoever in advance. They handed her and 40 other eighth graders their new schedules at the end of the day. There was no note attached to that schedule, no explanation, nothing sent with a new schedule, just a piece of paper handed to 40 13-year-olds. And I guess you guys imagine what happened with those, with 40 13-year-olds. I understand that the schools are struggling to cope with 400 extra students. And if this was a change in the schedule, a reorganization, I wouldn't have a problem with that. My problem was that my child has an IEP in math. She's in fundamentals of math. What was decided was that they would delete the fundamentals of math and that she would take two math courses, Math 8 and Math 108. To accommodate this change, the school made the decision to remove her from U.S. history without consulting me. There are a lot of other issues. We're not going to go into those, but one of the biggest things on that, besides the fact that my child wasn't in seventh grade math, and they moved her to eighth grade math, and I've helped her with the work, she's not at that level. But anyway, but my concern today is that in my effort to get this resolved, I was informed by the executive director of instruction that the Matsuda School District has no written or formal policy requiring advanced or actually any notification to parents with regard to significant schedule changes. It's best practice, and I was told it's best practice, but it's not formal. So, and I believe strongly that had this been a schedule change for students in gifted and talented programs, I don't think I'd be standing here. But this is for children's and fundamentals in math, and none of the parents were called. The fact remains that the administrators don't have to call in advance or even ever to make these significant changes, and I just don't think that's appropriate. Even if the child has an IEP, even if the parents have taken the time to meet each and every one of those child's teachers, even if they've asked to actively be included in the child's education, the district does not require parental pre-notification. That, school board members, is just not acceptable. Now, the executive director of instruction has informed me that the district will be developing a policy now, but I would believe strongly that this should go on a formal record that there is no policy, that there has never been one, but that the administration is currently working on one. Hopefully, it will remain on the radar of the school board until such a time as it is a formal policy. Thank you.
Next, we have Tim Walters.
Red button. Good evening. My name is Tim Walters. I am president of the Mat-Su Education Association. I represent about 1,200 teachers here in the Valley. Since school has started this year, I've had many members contact me about their class sizes. I know the board and administration have heard the same stories about huge class sizes, and you've worked hard to fix these problems as much as possible. I've let my membership know that you're aware of the problem and you're working on it. We get it. We all know and recognize that some class sizes are just too large. So, as the year moves forward, I'd like to share with you one of the realities of how large class sizes influence instruction. Teachers think about this stuff, and let me just preface this with, I know you're aware of the huge class sizes, and it's a concern to everyone. But again, teachers talk about this. If we look at a high school, Wasilla High, for instance, there are between 224 and 230 instructional minutes per week for each class period. Different class periods have different numbers of instructional minutes per week. In a class that has 230 instructional minutes per week, if there are 30 students in that class, then that means that each student has the ability to receive 7.67 minutes of individual instruction time per week. If it's a class that only has 224 minutes of instructional time per week, and there are 32 students in that class, which is easy, high school classes can easily be 32 plus, then that number drops down to 7 minutes of individual instructional time per week. It's a simple calculation, 224 divided by 32. If a teacher does 20 minute lessons during one of those shorter class periods, the 224 minutes, and there are 32 students in that class, the amount of individual instructional time per student drops to 4.5 minutes per week. Now, there are a lot of variables involved here. Do you do good things at the beginning of class? Has anyone been absent this week? Do you need to help them catch up? Does anything need reteaching? Will the entire football team be out on Friday? On and on. We get that. The reality, though, is that large class sizes affect students' opportunities to learn. We also understand that some students might not need their additional 4.5 minutes. This is just one metric. Each student might not need that 4.5 minutes, but we also know if you've been in the classroom, some students need 3 or 4 times that. It depends, week to week. Teachers are concerned about the amount of time they get to teach. I'm not sure if the district uses this metric or not, but it would be a useful way to start looking at how large class sizes affect instruction. Granted, it might not always be pretty, but it is reality. Thank you.
Are there any other members of the public who would like to come up and be heard by the school board? Seeing none, then we'll move on to administrative reports. Dr. Perramo.
Thank you, Madam President. At this time, I would like to request Executive Director Mike Verbolo to come forward. Mr. Verbolo is the executive director that works with curricular co-curricular activities, ADs, our largest school, our Mat-Su Central School, as well as working with principals and assistant principals in regard to the issue of class fees. And I'm just going to provide a little basis. This would be the start of the third year for which we are working on class fees. It was requested a few years ago when the issue came up from some parent concerns about the amount of money needed at the start of the school year to support classrooms. And when we took a look, we did see a vast difference of fees collected at different schools. And the amount did correlate highly with the socioeconomic status and the teacher time, which actually is serendipitous with just the last public comment in regard to teachers' time. A lot of teachers' time was spent on collecting those fees. We turned our staff into fee collectors, if you will, at some schools. And then we provided consequences in not allowing students to participate in after-school activities and others at some schools if they didn't have the funds for it. Other schools in the district just didn't address it at all, that if there were no fees, there were no fees. And so when we looked into it, there was a great amount of differences in the funds provided teachers just to run their classrooms. So from there, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Verbalo. He has worked for 18 months and in studying the situation, looking for a revenue source and the like that could be continual. This isn't just a one-time fix. This is actually something that we would look at being on a continual basis in support of teachers' classrooms for their supplies and other items that the teacher sees fit. Again, these are driven by the teacher's needs. Mr. Verbalo.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Promo. Dr. Promo, President Powers, and school board. This evening, as Dr. Promo just mentioned, I'm going to do a small presentation, a follow-up to last board meeting regarding class fees. We're going to start the presentation overview in three areas. We're going to look at our current policy, we're going to go over the history of class fees, and then an update of where we currently are. The current policy and regulation that we currently have starts with Administrative Regulation 3260. And 3260 states that high school fees will be collected at $15 to $20 per elective class per semester for a total of $40. However, we have a BP 3260 that correlates to that administrative regulation that states fees shall not be charged for required courses. As you can see, these two practices are in conflict with one another. For years, I was a building principal for 14 years. This conversation I can remember having with Dwight Propasco and other principals, they really are in conflict. We are collecting elective fees for courses that are required. And for our current senior class, the class of 2016, they have 8.5 elective credits that they have to achieve. For our junior class and every class thereafter, they're going to have 9.5 elective fees with science, math, English electives on top of that, as well as all their other required courses. So as you can see, the AR and the BP are really in conflict with one another as we have these classes that are required. And as a freshman and sophomore, you haven't met those requirements yet, although we're still charging for those courses. And so that's where the question started to come up years ago, and how are we going to deal with that? The history that we just went into a little bit, through school board direction and principal requests, we began to analyze the disparity in the fees collected with various schools. The results of the analysis brought about the following conclusions. There was inequity across schools and classrooms. And as Dr. Promo just talked about, when we looked at those different schools and classrooms, they really varied. Lower socioeconomic buildings may collect 35 to 40% of class fees. I was at Houston for years. I'd say that's about where we were at, 40 to 50% of class fees. Other schools may hit 50, 60. One of our schools hit 75 to 80%. But that was only one. The others were substantially lower. There is also the inconsistency that I just discussed between the administrative regulation and the board policy. Now an update for where we currently are. In collaboration with business services, instruction worked with building principals to increase discretionary funds according to a specific formula. So the first bullet points out, we examined the total possible fees that we could collect in all of our secondary schools. So we looked at all middle schools and all high schools, said, what does that number look like? Then we looked at each individual school and how much they actually collected. Then we determined that awarding schools 75% of those fees would be a fair, equitable way of giving money to the schools. And that was a long discussions that we had different building principals. It wasn't a decision we made overnight. We talked with them, like Dr. Promo said, for the last 18 months. What would be a fair, equitable way we could support you and your classrooms and the kids in your buildings? So now at this point, 75% of those fees are distributed among all the different secondary schools. This table I put in a Board Connect several weeks ago, you may notice. I'm just gonna go over it. This can be a little bit confusing. Those people that are listening, we have two tables. The first table is one with middle schools. The second table is high schools. I want you to look down below the high school table where it says FY15 expected fees. That is the amount that if we looked at all the high schools across the district how much we could possibly collect if we collected every single penny from every single student. That's the number that we would achieve. The 75% of expected fees, then we took 75%, multiplied it by that number, and that came out to be $818,890. Okay, the tables then take that amount, that 75%, and I'll use Colony as an example. They have 1,081 students. We then looked at Colony High School. That number is 30% of the secondary students. So they would get 30% of that $118,890. And so that's how the funds are dispersed among our district. Same with the middle school. I won't go into each of those examples, but it's the exact same way. It's fairly equitably distributed among all the secondary schools at 75% ratio. Summary, and this change in the practice that we've been doing with class fees, we know that it has been inconsistent with board policy, and we're trying to make it as consistent as possible. We're ensuring that there's equity among schools and individual students. We're trying to provide assistance to lower income families who may not have been able to pay those fees. The implementation, as Dr. Promo said earlier, and this is a big one, I think, for our principals and teachers, they'll no longer be forced to be in the collection of fees business. And it will lead with like capturing kids' hearts to better relationships and more instructional time for our teachers, which we know is important. And I don't think that can be understated enough. I can remember year after year, and I'm sure you guys have had calls in the past where parents are concerned with how the fees were collected. And you have kiddo in class and the teacher's having a dialogue trying to get those fees, it can get uncomfortable. And I think if we get the teachers out of that fees business, it's great for kids, it's great for everybody. Principals were ecstatic with the thought of going down this direction. In conclusion, the district will supplement school budgets based on student enrollment, as described before, in lieu of collecting those fees from parents. The cost is $235,000. These funds were identified through fall budget revision, which is before the school board tonight. And now I'm ready for any questions you may have.
I did want to add two pieces of information. If I might, this might answer. There was an article in the paper today from a teacher from a school for which they had the highest collection, but that collection over the last 2 years has only been 76%. So the teacher mentioned that she might be getting less because of this action, but when we looked at those data, the school received 76% of what they could have. Maybe her classroom was more. Actually, this is the first year in our classroom, so we're not sure, but that the school itself is not significantly lower, and that the fees that were collected in the past were collected online most times, and if they were collected in checks, then they were entered into the KEV group. So there is a record of fees that have been collected, and we could produce those. But again, this one wouldn't be parents paying through the KEV group, which is an online payment program. It actually will be directly placed into the school buildings for those to be delivered to those classes for which the fees and actually the expenses occur for supplies. And I just wanted to add those two things because that was as of today, that concern came up. And so I wanted to address it. And the concern from the author was also, I hope this doesn't go away next year. But administration has planned to that the funds, which are taken from the budget reserve, would continue. And it's the active operational reserve. It's not in our carryover. Thank you.
Member Larson.
You know, one other concern with the fees was, of course, once they're collected, where they go, mm-hmm. who keeps account of it, and what class do they go into, why do they go into the class? Because I can remember some of the fees were collected in classes that were just collecting fees that didn't need to be collected. So how's that all determined? What classrooms get this amount of money, and is there an accountability of where that money goes?
Great question. Yes, the building principals, and I talked with all but one of the high school principals today just regarding how they're disseminating the class fees. And it is set up at that 75% ratio, they're getting a certain amount of money. Now, they look at all the elective classes they have. They look at the number of students in those elective classes, and then it is spread out evenly per student. So if you had 100 kids in your class and you would typically get $20 per student, they get 15 now. That 15 times 100 kids, that teacher would get $1,500. So the principals across the board have spread that very evenly, very fairly to the current classes or the classes of the past that would be obtaining those fees, and then is given and spread out equally.
And just to clarify, so that it's not a check given to the teacher, it is actually deposited in the school's account. And when the teacher is in need of supplies or happens to buy supplies on his or her own, he or she may turn in a receipt for those funds for that class. So it is basically an account, not a check given to a teacher.
Member Rutherford.
Does each building have discretion, though, to certain electives have much higher cost in their materials that they use than other electives do. So doesn't the principal have discretion to, this class needs more and this class doesn't?
Yeah, absolutely. Each building has a discretionary account. And in talking with the principals, there's absolutely, and I think that article had pointed out, and I talked to that principal today, if there's a teacher that has specific needs, they have groups set up to really analyze what are the needs and assess those, and if needed additional funds, absolutely the principal does that. On top of it, I would say we also have for, I know in the past we've had questions on AP courses. We all have, they have accelerated funds that cover those classes as well. So there should be no fees for any courses unless they were going to allow, yet a student that wanted to keep their textbook and say an AP course, they could purchase it. But there should be no fees. And I'll say there, the only fee you may have would be in a shop class where you're going to build a dresser, or possibly in a welding class. Maybe I'll have my son build me a boat and I might have to put in a little bit. But other than that, there shouldn't be class fees.
Member Dearman.
Thank you. Mr. Verfalo, can we go back to your presentation?
Yes.
Is that possible?
Yep. Which part?
If we could count back, on your last slide, if we could count back three slides, I believe it is. It was your graph that had the 75% breakdown.
The tables?
Yes, sir.
Yep.
I think you know what I'm going to ask.
Is that the correct one? Oh, I'm sorry.
There it is. Okay. At the top, if you would, it says at the bottom by the asterisk, includes expected fees for Sioux Valley High School. And then at the bottom, it says excludes expected fees for Sioux Valley High School students. So if I, just as a layperson, look at that, I would look at that as a wash. And I would say then perhaps that Sioux Valley is not included at all. If you could please explain that.
You bet. The way that table is, it was just set up so they weren't broken down. And Mr. Fulp, correct me if I'm wrong, it was just broken down for the one school since they are 7 through 12. And so their student enrollment, you can see, is 179. That's inclusive of all their students. So that wasn't broken down in both tables. They just put it inside the one table, but that is their entire student body.
Okay, so it counts for the middle school and the high school.
They're getting funds for both middle and high school.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Good question. Yeah.
Member Welton.
And where does Reddington fit in here?
At the time, Madam President, we did not have Reddington numbers. This was done, or not Madam President, Madam Clerk, if you will, sorry. This was actually, this fee table was done last fall. We did not have student counts, didn't know, but the total amount will include Reddington.
Mm-hmm. All right, are there any other questions from the board? Member Larson.
Just want to make one statement. I am, most of my complaints that I've received since I've been on the board at the beginning of the year is, why do I have to come and register my child and bring my checkbook? And I'm just pleased to see that's not the case. And you're very much correct. A lot of lower economic people have not paid their fees, and I've seen people pay those people's fees, because if you really got an aggressive teacher that wants to get those fees, you end up with an issue. So I take my hat off to this, that now our parents don't have to wonder where the money's going to come from to register their kid to school. So, thank you.
Member Michelson.
Just a quick question about the fees for the AP courses. Mm-hmm. Was there a fee for the course and then a fee for the test? And are those eliminated? Because that's a college board, and that how does that fit into all this?
Through the president, there is a fee. Prior to this time, schools would charge a fee for those classes as well, the $40 fee. So that has been eliminated. And the only time is if they want to keep their book, which some students do because they want to write in it. But there is a fee to take the College Board assessment, similar to SAT and ACT, and the students do pay those. But with the College Board, there is a provision that they allow a waiver for low socioeconomic students to get those paid for. So we do have that, and that actually is sponsored by the College Board itself, and we assist in filling those out and verify the need. That's part of our jobs as counselors. But anyone who doesn't qualify in that range does actually pay for their AP exams. It is highly expensive if kids are taking three AP clips. Usually if they take one, they take more than one. So that could be something to look into. But it's, I believe, an additional $82.
All right, I do have to say something about those AP test fees. You pay $82 and you get three college credits, so it's quite a deal. All right, if there are no more questions, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that takes us to borough and city reports. I am not seeing any borough or city representatives here with us tonight, so we will move on to superintendent update and student advisory board. Member McDougall, if you would like to go first.
Yesterday we had an SAB meeting at Career Tech, and it was good to see Member Rutherford, Ms. Esri, and Dr. Promo. 13 schools were represented by 39 delegates, and it was mostly introductory information, like what Student Advisory Board is, the Constitution and Bylaws, and parliamentary procedure. And we also got into committees, and we will have more discussion time at our next meeting, October 13th, at Reddington Junior Senior High, 8:50 to 12. And the Fall OSOG Conference is in a month, October 15th through the 17th at Eagle River and Chugiak High. And I already know some students who have resolutions planned to bring to the floor, so it's great to see that they want to make some changes.
Thank you. Superintendent.
Thank you, Madam President. Luke Fulp is going to pull up the enrollment on the computers, but I also have a hard copy. I did want to mention including with preschool, we've mentioned our enrollment projection increase without preschool in the past as 280 around students, but if you include all students, it's 341 was what we predicted to have in addition this year, which was a steady growth, but growth nonetheless. We've exceeded that projection by 100% plus at 357. And so we're happy to report that that results in 698 students more in fiscal year 16, which is our current school year, than fiscal year 15, which was last school year. This is a growth rate of approximately 3.9%, up from our previous growth rate of about 1.75. About 5 years ago, my very first year as superintendent, we had a less than 1.5% growth rate. So it had been steady, but it certainly jumped delightfully for us. But as previously mentioned, it is a lot of movement and shifting. Yesterday, another teacher was provided to a school for which the student count in certain classes was too high, and so a teacher was just hired again yesterday. Another one was released. So we had added
12 and a half new certified positions for classroom teachers, but also in addition to that, our aides, as well as, you know, some other special education funding. So this isn't even updated as of the one yesterday. So, and we will go through that hiring process once the person is hired. We do have the substitute in there currently. So I wanted to share that with the board. It's exciting to us, and we look for continued growth. We did do a bit of research, and again, students from outside our borough, outside the state, but also students who we saw a significant amount of students, which I it was reported, and I followed up that had previously been in our district attending. Other schools, sometimes other homeschools or other private schools, and Reddington was a big draw for them. And so when Reddington opened, it was just a time for them to move because they visited the school, and that is a significant amount of students at one school from a local school that wasn't public. And so that actually, I followed up on that this weekend, and it was actually came to fruition that when the principal reported it. So is exciting. It also does cause lots of transitions. When we add a new teacher, it generally impacts over 100 students, 120 students it could possibly, and they do schedule. And we were aware of one instance and worked with the parent on that, and then did suggest that it is a good thing to have a policy like that. And calls had always been done. In fact, if you have a Colony High student, I believe a Connect Ed went out that they had received so many teachers that they did a Connect Ed to a lot of kids because they couldn't physically make the calls overnight. It was over 200 students. And so they sent out the kids affected. They sent out a call, just clicked them in a thing and the principal called. So we have had practice of that. It just, when we looked at it, it is in no, board policy isn't anywhere. So we would move forward with Ms. Welton's committee to perhaps bring policy together to the school board. Also, for a further update, I did want to share with you just some other news. There was a question in regard to, on our agenda tonight, some teachers who are working in special education positions, which are not certified in special education. However, they are certified as teachers. And the question came up is, you know, how does that work with the state? So I thought that was a great question and one that should be addressed publicly so our folks know. So there are state provisions for hard to fill positions. And there's a nationally shortage on special education teachers as well as in Alaska. We mitigated this by our top specialists that are very, very difficult to get by the board releasing contracts to 10 contracts. So we were able to get those specialists in speech, language, occupational therapy, physical therapy. But we still have a need for just in-classroom special education teachers that don't have that higher level of certification, if you will. So just to give the board a little idea, we hired 59 new special education teachers this year. Since last year. And that was a result of those that had retired or moved into general education. A lot of times it is heavy in paperwork for special education teachers. So a lot of times they work for 5 years in a position, transfer out to general ed, some transfer back. But nonetheless, we hired 59. Of those 59, we currently have 8 individuals who are not special education certified, but they are on a state waiver. And we assist them in applying for the state waiver, and they must have completed 9 special education credits and be enrolled in a program. So there are currently 8 individuals that this is occurring with, and so we look to have 8 more special education teachers as they complete their programs. We also have a provision which is only a 1-year long provision, and we have 6 individuals in this category where they are regular education teachers teaching special education positions. However, they are not solely responsible for the IEPs and paperwork. What we do is we typically hire retired special education teachers to be case managers and manage the casework where we have the general education teacher carrying out the IEP, the special education teacher would design it, because by law that is what occurs. So we pay special contracts to get those done. Of course, that is a one-year provision, and those teachers that are picked up in that manner are not rehired the next year. It is simply a one-year provision. They can be hired. Some teachers take it for 1 year and decide, wow, this is what I really want to do, and then they start a program, and then we can get them a waiver. And so it is a year-to-year. We do have a recruitment specialist working with us, and they have some exciting ideas on attracting folks to MATSU. And so I look to have smaller and smaller numbers in these areas. But currently, we do have 14 individuals working in special education classrooms that are either working on certification, 9 hours, almost halfway through, or they are being mentored and guided by a special education teacher and only carrying that out. And of course, almost all of our special education students are also taught by general education teachers in a conference with special education case managers. So that is a practice everywhere. That happens everywhere. So PE teachers, English teachers, everyone, I don't think there's probably a teacher in our district that isn't supporting student in special education. So that is a job for everyone. So I wanted to be sure to mention that. And we do have a new Teacher of the Year for 2016, and his name is Chris Wagner, and he's from Houston High School. And Chris will be celebrated at our next meeting on the 30th. And